The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are coming back to Atlanta. Right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Caitlin.
Yes, Jamie?
Do you know how we have a podcast?
Yeah?
And if we don't release an episode every single week, we'll die?
Yes.
Well, there's another rule.
What? What is the new rule?
We have to have sex with each other by midnight or the podcast will explode.
I mean, fine.
Look, I've got a magnifying glass. Do you want to? You can read it.
Okay. Oh, wow. Yeah, I see it. The fine print is right there.
Will you marry me? Yes or no?
Yes.
No pressure, but Christmas will die and children will hate each other if you don't do it.
Okay, fine.
So why don't you do it? Why don't you say yes?
I like to imagine that, like, when Jesus went back up to heaven, you know, he had a lot of free time on his hands. So
I'm listening.
God was like, all right, Christmas is your deal, you know? Like, whatever you want to do with it, feel free. Like, all this mythology and shit, and all these different holidays and shit. And so that, like, in my mind, the Santa Claus trilogy is a biblical epic that, at its origin, was carved out by Jesus Christ himself. So that he would have something to do up in heaven.
Yeah, who decides what the Santa Claus is? Much less the Santa Claus, the other one.
These clauses were written by him. These clauses were written
capital H, him.
By the Lamb. By Jesus Christ himself.
Does that also apply to the escape clause from 2006?
Certainly, yes. Oh. And because, like, Jesus, it's not really, this is... It's why Christmas is so secular. It's because Jesus' whole life is being Jesus. Mm-hmm. So when he approaches Christmas, he's like, I want to have some fun with it. Mm-hmm. So that's why you have the escape clause and the Mrs. Claus, et cetera, et cetera.
It's...
All right, we're starting the
so
podcast.
So depressing. Okay, so...
It's the last one, folks.
This is... Look, we're going out on top, which is... I mean, what's the point of continuing after we run out of Santa Claus movies? I was getting sad as I was preparing for this episode because I was like, damn, what are we going to do next December? We're out.
Oh, I do have an idea.
Oh, what is it?
I want to do all the Rankin Bass specials at once.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Rankin Bass, like, claymation specials.
Yeah.
I want to do an episode that's about all of them.
Wow. Like Heat Miser, Snow Miser, Santa Claus is coming to town. What?
Is it Rudolph? One of them?
Yeah.
There's a gnarly Rankin Bass special about the Easter Bunny. that involves like royal intrigue and like the royal family is trying to kill the Easter Bunny. It's pretty wild.
My favorite one is Jack Frost, which is Rankin Bass's like truly strong rebuttal of communism. We simply must put our foot down. We need to make a claymation special about why the Soviet Union is a threat. I mean, okay, maybe we can't cover them all in one because there's like
that's quite ambitious.
And there's also the not very much seen Little Drummer Boy 2, which is about market economies and barter systems.
Really?
Yes, 100%.
Grace, how do you know this? You may be the only person that's ever watched these.
I was alone a lot as a kid. If you have any question about me, usually the answer is I was alone a lot when I was a kid. Wow.
Sorry, Grace and I are actually just catching up. We were supposed to get dinner before she left town, and we both got busy, so we're just kind of catching up right now. So the Santa Claus 2, okay, so let's take it back a little bit and say that I nailed the introduction, and I think I brought the energy.
God. Jamie killed the introduction.
Thank you so much. And
I don't think I've been introduced yet, even.
Okay, so let's do that, and then we'll introduce the show, and then we'll do other stuff. Okay, so we're doing an episode on Santa Claus 2. Our guest is comedian, writer, you remember her from our episodes on The Santa Claus and The Santa Claus 3, and now it's time for The Santa Claus 2. It's Grace Freud. Hello and welcome back.
Hi, everybody.
Grace, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Now, can we just recap really quickly why we went 1-3-2? I know the answer, but I just want to make sure our listeners, in case we have listeners that have come in the past year, Grace has, I would say if you haven't listened to the first two Santa Claus episodes, maybe stop this episode
and go back
to 2019, because we covered it in a very particular order based on how much they interested us. And so we went 1-3-2, and this is the last one available for now. I really hope that we get to see...
2 hours ago, I literally texted both my managers and also the most famous person who was a friend of mine and was like, let's make a new The Santa Claus.
What do you say?
I really want to make a new The Santa Claus.
It seems like a safe bet.
And I think we're going to make it happen.
Let's see if Eric Lloyd is available. You know, is he it seems like maybe he's retired, but would he come back to play 37-year-old Charlie? Let's see. Let's just see.
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Okay, so the show that we're doing is called The Bechdel Cast, and it's our movie podcast where we analyze movies through an intersectional feminist lens.
We've been doing
this. You know
what?
We've been doing it. I think we should just skip what the Bechdel test is. We are short on time here today.
This doesn't pass it. Right?
You
don't even need to know what it is because
I watched through it twice and it doesn't.
It does.
So we're just gonna kinda gloss over what the show is, because here's what you're gonna do. You're gonna go back and listen to the other episodes and then you'll find out.
Two Mrs. Clauses to talk to each other about the only female elf who works at the North Pole for two lines of dialogue, and they both have to be named Mrs. Claus, and that doesn't happen in this movie. And there are so many daddy plot lines in this movie, and Scott's the daddy every single time.
Yeah.
He's so many people's daddies.
He really is.
He's really the dad. Like, he's even like Neil's daddy when you think about it.
Yeah, this movie has such like interesting sequel energy where it's like, oh, all these like pretty well-developed characters from the first movie. Now it's 8 years later and they're parodies of themselves. And some of them are not the same person anymore.
This movie has inside of it the perfect Christmas movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it really, like, in a weird way, the Santa Claus sequels kind of try to like MCU themselves. Like, they, like, pull in all of these other, like, mythological figures. They're like, here's a bunch of canon. that we're going to spew at you.
The whole council of legendary figures.
Yeah, exactly. Right. They lean into the small magical parts of the first movie, which really were kind of just sprinkled on and made the film beautiful and magical. But then they lean into it so hard that all of a sudden, the North Pole has a fucking, like, Blackwater.
Yeah.
You know?
They have
their own military and, like, all this shit.
They militarize the North Pole, and Santa Claus, the new Santa, he, like, self-identifies as a despot.
Yes.
Multiple times. Yeah. This is the fascist Santa Claus.
The Santa Claus 2 is maybe the most important work of art for understanding what 9/11 did to America.
I honestly don't think you're very far off there at all. Because you were just like, what happened between 1994 and 2002? Because this came out, okay, so for the audience, this came out Christmas season 2002.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, let's see when it was shot. I'm not quite sure. Oh, it was supposed to be. Okay, this is interesting. I don't have an inside look. I have two sentences on Wikipedia, but I'm going to run with this.
Please.
It was supposed to come out on November 21st, 2001, was postponed until 2002.
The following year.
I wonder what changed, if anything, in the movie between, you know, when it was made pre-9/11 in 2001 and 2002, when there's a despot that needs to be overthrown and there's a heavily militarized, you know, nutcracker army. And there's at the end of the day, all I care about is David Krumholtz there and am I still in love with him? And it's yes and yes.
He's still there, but not quite enough.
No, he's a prisoner. He's a POW in this one.
Yeah.
They make David Krumholtz a POW in the Santa Claus 2.
I would say, you know what? I'm going to lay it all on the line and say probably 50% of the movie changed post 9/11. That's what I'm going to say.
I mean, a big change I noticed was, speaking of David Krumholtz, his wig is no longer white guy with dreads. It's now just tight curls.
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
And I think that's a big improvement.
He still looks good.
Someone talked like... Someone talked to the elves had to get a sensitivity training.
There's a there. I was talking to someone. Did you see that Ashley Ray tweet about how Bernard the elf was like a formative sexual experience for like a large swath of young
yes.
people?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I really do think Bernard the elf transcends gender. Like I yeah. do think. That is a non-binary character on screen. And I think just that in and of itself makes you ask questions of like, well, if it's not a binary, then what does it mean to like someone who isn't going to fit into that?
And that's where Bernard comes in. I like that.
Okay, so real quick...
Okay.
Grace, what's your relationship with this particular movie and the franchise as a whole?
I believe that this movie is the last movie I saw with my dad before he died. I think I've said this before, but I think it was it was this one.
This is the 2002 one?
Yes. My dad died in 2003.
Okay.
Wait a sec. Wait, when did this movie come out?
2002. So that does. That
so
does
Christmas drop. Season 2002.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't. No. It was. I saw this with his brother, my Uncle Mark.
Okay.
And I think he was there. In my mind, he's there, but that doesn't quite add up timeline wise.
Okay.
I'm so sorry if I just messed with the mythology of the Battlecast. Battlecast fans, don't hate me.
It's absolutely
I never
your
really
life.
Added
it's
it up in my head before. But, I mean, my dad died, so like really nothing. You couldn't do something worse to me. But But so point being, this movie came out at a very tumultuous time of my life.
Yeah.
And I do remember seeing it and thinking, oh, you know, maybe my dad just needs a wife. I guess we'll never know if, like, my dad would still be alive today if he had simply gotten a wife by Christmas Day 2002.
It makes you think.
Wow.
It makes you think.
So you have a very interesting relationship with this movie, is what you're saying.
I mean, and yeah, and hopefully everyone has listened through the first 5 hours of information we have on this franchise, on this podcast.
Yes. And, yeah. Yes. Jamie, what about you? What's your relationship?
Oh, I remember seeing this movie in theaters. I remember being like, wow, Charlie's bad now, huh? Oh, Charlie's bad? Oh, yes. he's putting a big old red circle with a line through it over a Christmas tree? Ah.
That rocked me. I was so shocked. I remember being in the theater and being like, Charlie, what? No. What are you doing?
He's the cutest cutie pie. And he's so, I mean, it's like this movie did come out 8 years later. So, but for a kid that was watching the Santa Claus every year, very jarring to see Charlie be preteen bad boy about to give a girl a kiss because she's like, sometimes it feels good to be bad. And you're like, whoa, okay. So that is, I mainly remember this. I mean, also, I just remember there were so many movies in this specific era, like all the time. But in this era, there were a lot of Disney movies with this premise where it's like, kind of like the beautiful, perfect intro I did, where it's like, if Santa doesn't get married at midnight, we're going to cut his head off and you're all fucked. Like this similar premise was in The Princess Diaries too. That came out. I think, a couple of years after this, where it's like, she's not going to be royal anymore unless she gets married tomorrow. So what's she going to do, huh? And then that's the whole movie. And this is kind of a more militarized version of that story at the North Pole. Mm-hmm. I don't know why these movies came out within 2 years of each other. I don't know why these stakes are so... It's so weird because it's like these are stakes that are associated with like times where women were considered property and not like middle school principals, but this movie overlooks that and they're like, well, why not both?
Yeah, it truly, like,
it's fucked. It's fucking weird. Like,
it's really fucked up. Like, I think it would be significantly less fucked up if the ending was slightly different.
But oh my gosh,
the way that he presents, the way that he like convinces, we can get to that later.
We'll get there.
That proposal is, oh my it's god,
wretched.
Yeah,
so wretched, and it takes something that like, yeah, we can analyze it by like, you need a woman as if you need like a house or something, like as if like a piece of property. But before that, I think that like it does come off as, in general, like kind of sweet. Oh, this is a cool little rom-com. And then that happens and it's like, Jesus Christ, Santa, what did you do?
It's very scary.
Like, at the very end, there has to be some way to navigate around this claw. Like, get a lawyer, Santa. There has to be a way around this. You don't need to put the literal weight of the world. Like, and I like how they, I don't like, but like, they try to frame it as a joke. They're like, haha, no pressure. But all the joy in the world will disappear unless you marry me right now. And she's like, well, can I? And then the way they girl boss this character is honestly ahead of its time.
What's your relationship to it, Caitlin?
Sorry. Yes.
I had never seen this one. I grew up with the first Santa Claus movie and I watched it a ton as a kid. But by the time this one came out, I had aged out of this type of movie. So I didn't see the second or third Santa Claus movie until prepping for last year's episode that we did on Santa Claus 3.
So you never saw The Marriage at Gunpoint Santa Claus?
No, I did not. So my history with this installment in the franchise is quite brief. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about it.
This is the Hereditary of Santa Claus movies.
I will say, I do, like, as horrifying as it is, I do feel like I got a little bit of nostalgia that I'm dubious about. But I was like, wow, there's a lot of body horror in this film franchise. I feel like you don't get that kind of body horror in children's media today. Although maybe I'm just not watching enough. And they are doing very scary things.
Well, Paddington certainly doesn't have any body horror, I'll tell you that right now. Let's take a quick break, and then we will come back for the recap.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Okay, I'm going to try to get through this as quickly as possible.
Ooh, good luck. Here we go.
Okay, so Santa Claus 2 opens with a plane flying over the North Pole and almost detecting Santa's workshop with their like radar or whatever. Mm-hmm. So Santa Claus, aka Tim Allen.
Because all of this infinite magic cannot block an oil plane's
so confusing
fucking radar. Like, all this, like, beautiful magic cannot do the same as soundproofing. You know, like I guess they should have put some foam
jacket over the North Pole, and that probably would have
does not add up. But Santa Claus and Bernard and several other of the elf employees have to go to ElfCon 1, and during this we meet Curtis.
Okay,
that's Spencer Breslin.
ElfCon 1, like, pump the brakes. There's an ElfCon 1 because it's the winter of 2002 and everyone is in a very negative place on these issues.
And let us recognize for a moment that ElfCon 1 is normal. That is what they are at in times of peace. Because at the end of this sequence, Santa goes, let's go back to ElfCon 1. They are always on alert. They are always prepared and in fear of the specter of a terrorist attack on the North Pole. And not only that, but Santa multiple times references military strategy, which suggests to me that Tim Allen's Santa Claus is a well-read military general.
I recall that in the Santa Claus one, there is a hint at militarized elves. I believe that there's an elf, it's like a CIA or FBI kind of thing. So there's like not no precedent for this.
Well, it's special forces. I think it comes off more as like a SWAT team almost, you know?
Yes.
But it's fun. The difference there is it's goofy.
Yeah.
You know, it plays more like Power Rangers and less like the U.S. military.
And the scale feels much smaller than ElfCon 1.
Yeah, it's like five elves.
It's a small operation. Not saying it's the best thing in the world, but ElfCon 1 is definitely an escalation from the 1994 militarized elves.
But at the same time, this is all an aesthetic thing. Because all of a sudden, Santa is in military garb with a special military hat with medals and shouting out orders. And they eventually go up all the way to ElfCon 4. But nothing, they don't do anything. They do nothing but tell people to be quiet.
Right.
They don't launch missiles or anything.
It's a waste of taxpayers' money.
It really
is. It's a waste of elf taxpayers' money.
It's a waste of elf taxpayer money.
What's also wild about this is that this has nothing to do with the rest of the plot of the movie.
Yeah, so it's like Santa needs to get married. That's shitty, but that's enough to do the movie. You don't need to add a war. Like,
if anything, it softens the B plot of the film, which is this toy Santa that militarizes the North Pole. It's like you see that happen and you're like, what do you mean? Like, that already happened. Like, we already saw the real Santa bring it all the way up to ElfCon 4. In this scenario, the real Santa is Barack Obama and the toy Santa is George W. Bush. Like, Barack Obama still did a lot of drone strikes, you know? But when he came into office, people were like, all right, it's chill. The wars are going to be good now, you know?
Right. And then that carries through to the Santa Claus 3, which you can pause this episode right now and go back and then
Jack Frost is Donald Trump.
There, exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
I'm also realizing that Spencer Breslin was also in The Princess Diaries 2, meaning that he's really kind of a popular choice for this exact premise. If this premise is happening on the big screen and there's an arranged forced marriage happening on screen, you got to get this kid around.
Got to get Spencer in there.
Yeah, Spencer Breslin, really. There was an era. There was really a Spencer Breslin era.
So Spencer Breslin plays Curtis, who's an elf. And then we see Santa playing a game of football with the elves. Basically, everyone is having fun, except there's one little thing where Curtis and Bernard have something that they need to tell Santa very soon. We'll put a pin in that. Meanwhile, Santa's son, Charlie, who is now a teenager and kind of a rebel.
Did you not love the... I hope it was written for the movie. Whatever the fuck that song is, when he's doing his little graffiti where it's like, I've been a naughty Santa boy. I don't deserve a toy. Like, it was like Fat Boy Christmas. It was so funny.
It really is like they just... They gave someone's uncle $500 like, just write a few new...
They were like, go off, Christmas King. He's songs. Been a naughty boy.
It's just you and your guitar, man. Just fucking do what you need to do, dude.
I love Bad Boy Charlie. He's a good graffiti artist. He's so talented. Get this kid in an art class. Truly. Direct this energy.
He's spray painting on a wall at school to impress a girl and also like call out the principal for hating Christmas.
It's pro Christmas spray paint.
Yeah.
And everything that Charlie just continually gets in trouble for spray painting pro Christmas messages throughout the school.
It's very funny. And he gets caught by the school principal, Principal Newman.
Yeah.
So then back at the North Pole, Santa finds out that not only is his son Charlie on the naughty list for getting in trouble at school, but also there's another Santa Claus with an E. There's another legally binding clause that says...
The Mrs. Claus.
Little Spencer Breslin really has to do a lot of heavy lifting exposition-wise in this scene. Yeah. The line they give him is so funny. He's like, I know, there's a Santa Claus, but guess what? There's another Santa Claus, and I'm sorry, and I should have let you read it, but I didn't have a big enough magnifying glass. Here, I have 500 magnifying glasses, and now you can read it, and that's the movie. And like, he has to say all of this in like one breath, but he does it.
And then after Santa's looked at the claws and found out he needs to marry a woman, it also specifies a woman. It's very clearly. It does not say just marry. It says you need to pick a woman and then marry her. And
and that's on Jesus Christ for writing that down.
It really is on Jesus Christ for writing it like that. I would also note, nowhere in that clause does it specify they have to love each other.
Correct.
Wow.
Like, which to me is almost not very Christmassy. Like, you know, like you would think that like true love, you know, would be like an important power, like little engine of Christmas cheer.
Wow, that didn't even occur to me.
But that's not what it's about. What it's about is the marriage.
Yeah.
And then after that, Spencer again is given the acting challenge of his life, and he goes big. Maybe too big. I don't know if it quite works.
I love when he goes
but
big.
Like, kudos to him. And he goes like, the desantification process has begun.
Yes.
And it almost takes me out of the movie, to tell you the truth. He goes that big. But he really does illustrate the stakes.
Certainly. So to provide the context here, Santa has to find a woman and get married to her. And if he doesn't do that by Christmas Eve, which is only 28 days away, he will cease to be Santa. And as Curtis points out, the de-Santification process has begun, where he has started to look less and less like Santa and more like his former self, Scott Calvin.
Right.
Immediately after this, there's a meeting of the Council of Legendary Figures. We've got Mother Earth, we've got Father Time, the Easter Bunny, Cupid, Sandman, Tooth Fairy.
And no Jack Frost. Jack Frost only pops up in the next movie. It's like...
That's true. I feel like the council is better utilized in the third movie. In this one, they're kind of like, I'm thrilled to see them. I love a good Aisha Tyler performance, but it's like, they're not doing much, except with the exception of the Tooth Fairy, who became intimately involved.
Yeah.
This scene seems to only happen because we need to establish that the Tooth Fairy is a person, because that's going to pay off later.
Mm-hmm. I feel like you didn't actually need that. You could have just, truly. I like, it wouldn't have blown my mind if the Tooth Fairy just showed up and I was like, well, yeah, that makes sense.
I agree.
Santa's real.
There's like three movies fighting to be the movie here. One of the movies is a rom-com. Mm-hmm. One of the movies is a grand mythological Christmas movie. And then another one of the movies is essentially the Christmas version of Thin Red Line.
uh-huh. Yeah.
And if it had just been the rom-com, it could have been one of the best Christmas rom-coms ever.
It still would have been super dated, but it would have, like, made sense.
Yeah, it could have been really fun and cool, you know. Like, the concept of, like, there needing to be a Mrs. Claus, like, I think they could have played it in a way that didn't quite come off as property, you know.
Yeah, if they had, like, given themselves the, if they had taken away from the fascism plotline and maybe characterized and fleshed out the rom-com plot line, maybe it would have been a little different, and changed the wording of Jesus Christ's claws to make it less menacing.
Yes, maybe. exactly. If Jesus had, if the diegetic Jesus of this universe had been a little more thoughtful in how he wrote these clauses, it would have been a better movie.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't know what we're talking about, because it took 5 whole men to write this movie. So I don't, there's, I just think it's, I mean, I know that that's how these movies work, but it just, it is always funny to me to see how many writers are credited on movies like this. And they're just like, really hard to understand, like, who I'm like, okay, so which of these writers, Don, Cinco, Ken, Ed, and John, really wanted the fascism plot to happen? Which of them wanted the rom-com? Which of them wanted Bad Boy Charlie? Like, I want plot points attributed so I know who to avoid in the future.
Oh gosh. Okay, so now Scott, aka Santa, has to go back down to Chicago or wherever his family lives to deal with his son Charlie and to find his wife. But he also has, you know, Santa responsibilities at the North Pole. So this is when Curtis gets the idea to use this machine that they have, which will make a toy version of Santa who will run the North Pole while real Santa goes and does the stuff he has to do.
Right.
So Santa takes Comet and they head to Chicago, where Scott links up with his ex-wife Laura and her husband Neil. And they
immediately fuck right in front of Neil. They just fucking go for it.
I thought it was...
When Caitlin said links up, she meant...
That's what I meant. Yes. Up. And then after that, they go and meet with Principal Newman to talk about Charlie getting into trouble. Mm-hmm. And Principal Newman and Scott have met before and they hate each other.
Because she's a public school educator, which means that she's evil.
Yeah, this movie hates public schools.
Yeah, like with a fiery hatred that only 5 rich guys could have committed to the page. But I thought it was interesting that it seems like all of the qualities that were annoying to Scott about Laura in the first movie, she no longer has in this movie. Her character has basically been like sapped from her body, and those qualities now exist in the principal.
All she does is say, "You're a good dad, Scott."
Yeah.
You're a good dad and a better father and a good man.
And a good Santa.
She can't stop saying what a good father he is, even though he is largely absent. Like, it just, like, I just thought it was very bizarre how, like, her character, like, it's Neil's character was turned up to an 11 and her character was just, like, disappeared.
It's gone.
Yeah.
It's, there's nothing.
Yeah.
There's nothing there.
Bums me out.
She's only there to say, You did nothing wrong. You've done, you are okay.
And it's like, did you even see the first movie, Laura?
Yeah. Because... It's very hard to, like, talk about, like, really what was Scott's emotional arc in this? Because, like,
right,
constantly the movie is telling you there's nothing wrong with him and he did nothing wrong. But he still has to do this shit, you know?
It seems like at different points they're implying, like, well, part of the reason Charlie's getting in trouble is because Scott is so absent, which I could conceive of. But then that kind of goes away and they're like, no, Charlie's just acting out because he's in love with Christmas and he hates that he can't tell everyone that his dad is Santa. You're like, well, that's
exactly a
less interesting problem to explore.
Really, Charlie's arc is accepting that it's wrong of him to miss his father.
Right. Like,
yeah.
It's wrong. That's incorrect behavior.
That ending exchange was chilling to me between Charlie and his sister, Lucy, where he, what does he say? He says, knowing isn't a burden. It's a gift. And you're like, it's kind of a burden for you, Charlie. Yeah. Like, we gotta, God.
And the Lucy stuff is a whole nother movie, honest to God.
Oh my gosh.
Like, that's competing. Lucy is Charlie's little sister.
Yeah.
She's a big Santa fan.
Oh, she loves Santa.
Yeah, there are several new female characters introduced in this movie, and there's lots to talk about with all of them.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the thing of it is, like, for a movie that is ostensibly about, that's ostensibly, that wants to sell it to you as a romantic comedy about Santa finding his Mrs. Claus, the last 10 minutes of the movie don't even have Mrs. Claus in it. Like, it's just a whole nother deal, like wrapping up this other thread,
and then she appears in the credits.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Okay, so back at Laura and Neil's house, this is when we meet their young daughter Lucy, who Santa / Scott has a very close relationship with. And again, Santa, who is now looking more and more like Scott Calvin, he has started to try to meet women.
Yeah.
For example, he goes on a date with Molly Shannon, who is obsessed with Christmas, but in like a freaky way, so it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to complain about that scene being there because Molly Shannon is amazing, but what? And then I liked how at the end she's like, oh, you don't support my music career? Well, you don't support women. And I was like, Yeah. You don't support women if you don't support me being annoying at a restaurant. That's exactly what I think is true.
That's exactly it.
It was almost like that joke felt like a joke like making fun of Me Too, but like from like,
but in 2002, I was just like, ultimately I agree with her. If you don't support me yelling at a restaurant, you hate women. Period.
Like, believe women? Are you saying I'm supposed to believe that woman that thinks her singing voice is good? I don't think so.
I didn't really know where that scene was going, but always happy to see Molly Shannon. I don't know.
I mean, she kills it.
Yeah.
She certainly kills it. I would say that, honestly, that scene doesn't go far enough. Like, yeah. I wish they had really let her unleash herself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's never full on belting, you know, which is disappointing to me.
Maybe in Santa Claus 4 we'll bring her back.
In my hard reboot, she'll be playing an entirely different character.
Hell, oh, good. Yeah. Good.
Okay, so meanwhile, up at the North Pole, Toy Santa is taking the rules too seriously and is becoming a bit of a tyrant. Basically, he wants all the kids to be on the naughty list.
Mm-hmm.
Then Charlie gets in trouble at school again. And
for more pro-Christmas graffiti,
yes,
by the way.
For doing, quite honestly, even better graffiti than he did the first
oh,
time.
Oh, yeah. His graffiti, by the way, looks professional.
It looks like, really... Shout out to whatever production designer was doing that. It looks great,
yeah,
right?
I mean, really, I honestly, watching this, I was like, am I forgetting that at some point the principal or someone is like, listen, Charlie, stop messing around. You're good. You're really good. But you gotta stop with this graffiti and start picking up a paintbrush, you know?
Also, the graffiti says, trim a tree, go to jail, is what it says. That's what the principal is saying.
Which is not even clever.
I think it's very powerful and maybe a little scary.
It's so odd to me that such a secular
film, go to jail,
a Christmas movie that does not mention Jesus once, that doesn't have a single cross, also has a character, in this case Santa Claus himself, Scott Calvin, confront the principal and be like, why aren't there any Christmas trees in this school? Why aren't there any lights and tinsel? And she's very reasonably like, hey, it's a public school. And he's like, well, gosh, golly,
but,
God darn it. Here's some money for a wreath.
But she says it's a public school. therefore we don't have the funding for Christmas decorations. Not, it's a public school because separation of church and state. Like, she cites the wrong reason.
Yeah.
And not for nothing, but like, I mean, my experience in public school was that there was a lot of holiday stuff.
Yeah, same.
Like,
I
did not find that to be washed out. I mean, and to the point where maybe it was warranted to be like, hey, why is there so much Christmas stuff in
this public school?
In the separation of church and state school. But I never found that there was any lack of, like, celebrating literally any holidays, including the fucked up ones that indoctrinate you into all sorts of messed up shit.
Yeah.
So I don't even know, like, what it's supposed to be commenting on, because I don't really know of public school kids that weren't exposed to a ton of Christmas stuff
right.
at school.
Right.
Yeah.
We sang Christmas songs in choir.
Yeah.
Santa came to school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sorry, I didn't go to some fancy Massachusetts private school with a school Santa, but that sounds pretty cool.
I'm telling you, I went to public school, Grace, and there
I
was,
know, but
Tim
I,
Allen
but
would
in
come.
Massachusetts, the mm-hmm. golden gilded state of the union.
Oh my God. I grew up in one of the, iconically, it was voted 2005's worst 100 places to live in the United States.
Oh my God. Okay, so Charlie gets in trouble at school. Principal Newman, whose first name is Carol, by the way, Christmas Carol,
yeah.
She makes Charlie and Scott do community service, where Carol and Scott warm up to each other a bit. And then later that night, or some night shortly after that, Scott shows up at her house and asks if she would like to get a bite to eat with him. But she was headed to the faculty Christmas party, so she invites him along.
And she is so thirsty that she's like, yeah, weird dad that I hated until this morning. For sure. I think it's important to note that The Santa Claus 2 is actually an adaptation of the novel The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith, which many will know for its other film adaptation, Carol. The Santa Claus 2 takes a lot of liberties. Basically, all it pulls from The Price of Salt is that there's a woman named Carol and it happens at Christmas time. But it is cool, at least, that there's a Disney movie that was based on a novel written by a dyke icon.
Mm. It's true. And we've covered Carol on this very show.
Yes, we have. So shout out to the movie Carol.
Yeah, two different
and shout out to the movie
versions.
The Santa Claus 2. Yeah.
But yeah, he shows up. He's like,
he shows up.
And also, there's so many points in this film where it's like, you really couldn't beat that, you know? Like jokes where you're like, you really couldn't beat him being like, oh, I just want to ask, do you want to go get noodles and pie? Like, you couldn't beat that. Come on.
Yes.
So he shows up. She invites him to her Christmas party. He uses some of his Santa magic to take her there in a horse-drawn sleigh. Mm-hmm. And they chat along the way. They get to know each other a little bit better. Then they go
she
to
has
the
Christmas-based trauma.
Yes.
She's like, yeah. Oh yeah, it's what my parents told me. Grow up, because Christmas reasons. And she's like, and that's
because
why
she punched.
Like,
didn't she punch someone?
She got in a fight
kid.
At school, yes.
Who was saying Santa isn't real.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many, not so many, but like two or three moments in this movie where it's implied that, like, it is a deep psychic wound that has led Carol to become a public school teacher. Like, I don't know why this movie hates public school teachers so much, because it's also implied that her, like, weird Christmas trauma is like, and that's why I'm the meanest teacher in the whole world. You're like, this is
well,
so
bizarre. I gotta admit that I had a Christmas committed psychic wound that led me to becoming a comedy writer, which was that I found out Santa wasn't real because I was reading the Sunday Funnies, and there was, like, one of those, it wasn't the Far Side, it was like a Far Side ripoff, you know, like,
oh god,
single panel comic called, like F is for Fake or something.
Okay.
And there was a comic about how Santa wasn't real, and for whatever reason, like, I read the Funnies every day, and I got the joke, and the way this joke was positioned, for whatever reason, really convinced me. I was like, wow, that must mean, I mean, this joke wouldn't make sense if he was real. I don't know, like, I was just like, wow, Santa for real definitely doesn't exist. And because of that, I became a comedian, because I want to prove that you can do good comedy without telling kids that Santa isn't real.
See,
so if any kids are listening to this right now, Santa is real, actually. Mm. We've just been goofing, but Santa is real.
Yeah, I hope that if kids are still listening to this, Santa is real. I feel like I double and triple down on finding out Santa wasn't real each and every year by adding more Santas to Santa University and just, you know, adding a multiplier to the number, the sheer number of Santas that are real, but also very mortal, you know.
True.
Much like these Santas, much like Scott.
Scott will die if he doesn't find a wife so soon, which is why he goes to the party with Carol, and it's the, and the party,
and
is
she's back.
Dull.
Mm-hmm.
So Scott uses some more of his Santa magic to liven it up, and he gives all the partygoers a bunch of gifts.
Classic retro toys.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he's running out of his Santa magic, which means he's going to have trouble getting back to the North Pole. I forgot to add that part in there. Mm-hmm. But Carol is suspicious of Scott and all the magic he seems to be using, but she's also dazzled. And Carol and Scott kiss.
And it's a bad kiss. Sorry, it's a really bad... I'm like, we can't get a second take on this kiss. They're just like... Sometimes you're just like, wow, a kiss... Like, it's a kiss that made me think, wow, a kiss is just two faces next to each other.
I mean, to be fair to the filmmakers, Scott is like, I haven't done this in a while. But truly, I mean, like, come on, man. It's, like,
I mean, Tim Allen is disgusting. And
also, like... I would say that the original Santa Claus suggests that he kind of has game. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm not saying he has respectful game. I'm not saying he's a good person.
No.
But I am saying that the original Santa Claus kind of suggests that Scott Calvin has game.
Yeah.
I agree. And it's like, I mean, I feel like, you know, you do have the evil Tim Allen represented in this movie through Fashy Santa Claus. I feel like I can see Fashy Santa Claus easily texting Karl Marx Communist Manifesto Wikipedia every single morning, probably no problem. Mm-hmm. But Scott Calvin, the centrist Santa Claus, if you will. Mm-hmm. Just a sexless weirdo in this one. Really doesn't really plant one on the woman he will very soon basically force to marry him.
If you are ideologically standing on sand, then your dick's going to be as wobbly as your legs. Which I think Scott Calvin...
Sounds like a Bible verse when you say it like film. That. Wow. I can just see that in like a cursive font on a picture of sand.
Okay, so there's a gross kiss, and then he tells Carol that he is Santa Claus, but she thinks that he is mocking her, and she doesn't believe him, so she kicks him out of her house. Mm-hmm. Then Scott and his son Charlie have an argument because Charlie is resentful of having to keep the secret that his dad is Santa, and he's also upset that his dad is
his
principal and didn't even tell Charlie about it.
Oh, fuck. That means Charlie's in danger of becoming a public school principal.
I know. Right. With all this Christmas-related trauma that he's experiencing.
Stop that. He's got to... I mean, come on. You don't want your kid to be a public school principal. You want your kid to be a charter school principal so they can defraud the school out of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Right. That's the dream.
Okay.
I would also like to say that, interestingly enough, Carol says something, maybe like the only thing I've ever seen in a Disney movie that approaches being like really body fat positive, whatever, at least from that time, from when I was growing up, not like the more recent ones.
Mm-hmm.
Disney, yes, queen, you're really doing it. Thank you. Now,
no one's doing it like you, girl.
So at one point, Scott tells Carol, before he says that he's Santa, he's like, I'm usually a lot more bigger than this. And she goes, that's okay. I am sometimes too.
Yeah.
I thought that was beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought, because like, she's.
I liked that.
She's seen him when he's really fat before. Like, that's, you know, she's seen
oh,
it
Rick,
when he's
yes,
big.
Yeah,
and I was like,
him.
Oh, I love Carol. Yes, Carol. And I've actually, the whole movie, I liked yeah. Carol as a character. I thought she was, like, fun. And that's what makes what's about to happen even more tragic, because, like, in the ending bit of this, they do what they did to Scott's wife. They lobotomize Carol and turn her into, like, just another little, like, one of his wenches.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
And I do think it's, like, Carol, I agree with you. I feel like, I mean, I don't love how she's written at a lot of points, and I feel like they really, like, make her evil at work in a way that feels pretty gendered, of like, oh, you know, like women have to be really mean at work or people won't take them seriously kind of thing. But I feel like there is an angle from which you can see Carol where it's like, you know, she projects this very intense image at school, but then like among friends, she's chill, she's fun. And I feel like that is actually a real teacher archetype that exists in the world. I've had teachers like that who are like friends with my parents or like friends with, or like neighbors, and they're not scary in a neighbor context, but when they're like, dance faster, Jamie, they're scary. And so I just wanted to shout out Miss Carol Thomas from Brockton High School, who was yelling at me to dance faster, but she was my cousin's neighbor and she was nice.
Okay.
Carols like that exist.
So at the North Pole, back at the North Pole, Toy Santa is now a fascist dictator who has built an army of toy soldiers, and he is hell-bent on giving all the children in the world lumps of coal.
He says, I am a despot.
Yes, he does. He's like, despot? Yes!
He just says that out loud on purpose.
I really think that if they wanted to actually do that, they should have gone all the way and they should have had him kill Bernard.
I mean,
don't I have so few things.
He should have had him cut Bernard's head off and held it up over the Alps and screamed, is this what you want? Is this what you want to happen to you? Ha ha ha! I guess he really is the head elf now. And that would have made sense too. Because Bernard isn't in the third film.
Wow.
Instead, Toy Santa just arrests Bernard.
Yeah, and he's still a POW.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So then Curtis the elf goes to Scott and tells him about the problems with Toy Santa, but Scott can't get back to the North Pole because he used up too much of his Santa magic. And Comet cannot fly because he ate too much candy and gained a lot of weight. So even
really
though there's that one moment in the movie, there's still quite a bit of fat phobia in this
film. Comet farts a bunch, like...
Yeah.
God. I mean, in like the most, like, I mean, and this is not the worst part of that scene because this is like a very like fat phobic moment. But the fart sound effect that they choose really does sound like fart.mp3. It is the most uninspired fart sound I've ever heard in all of cinema. Yeah. I'm like, you gotta make your farts custom with this. What? Wait, let's check in on the budget. This movie had a $65 million budget, and they played fart.mp3. Unconscionable.
And in 2002.
So they can't get back to the North Pole, so they have to call upon the Tooth Fairy to get Scott back to the North Pole. Meanwhile, Charlie shows Carol the magic snow globe that Bernard had given him in the first movie to get her to believe that Scott is Santa, and I don't understand how that works, but it does, and now she believes.
It just shines. A bright light comes out of it, and she's like, fuck, dude. Your dad is Santa.
Your dad is Santa. Holy shit. So back at the North Pole, Scott tries to confront Toy Santa, who captures Scott and Curtis, but then the Tooth Fairy shows up again with Charlie and Carol, who untie Scott, and then he and the elves go to try to stop Toy Santa, but it's too late. Toy Santa has already left to deliver all the coal to the children of the world, because I guess now it's also Christmas Eve? Question mark?
Yeah, that happened pretty quickly. I wasn't clear on that either.
But real Santa chases after dictator Toy Santa on this reindeer in training named Chet, and he successfully stops Toy Santa, and then the elves...
In the most uninspired action sequence.
It's really bad.
It's truly
a
bummer.
My God, Tim Allen does a line from Toy Story in that action sequence.
You're, what is it? Like, you're sad, strange little man. You're sad, strange.
But Toy Story came out 7 years ago at that point. Why is he doing that?
I'm not sure.
Hard to say.
They had five writers, but they were still missing a line when they turned it in. So the producers had to copy and paste something from one of his other movies.
You should have said Karl Marx Communist Manifesto Wikipedia.
Oh my gosh.
That would have been that would have really, you know, gussied it up.
He should have done like a quote from Benito Mussolini. He should have he should have said something about how he kept the sleigh running on time or something.
Oh my god. That is on par with the beheading Bernard suggestion.
Okay, so Christmas is saved, but Scott has to tell Carol that he can't keep being Santa unless he finds a Mrs. Claus. So then he proposes to Carol, and she says yes, and then they get married that night, and then he delivers the toys around the world, and then the movie ends with Scott and Charlie and Lucy having a nice, tender moment. That's the end of the movie. Let's take a quick break, and then we will come back to discuss.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Okay, so what haven't we covered at this point?
There's like quite a lot, I would say.
There's a lot.
There's so much stuff to talk about. There's the proposal.
Okay, so...
Yeah, let's talk about what happens to poor Carol, who I do agree. I essentially like Carol. I feel like there is enough written about her that you're like, I like this lady. I see why she and Scott are mostly... It's not the least chemistry I've ever seen between two characters.
Yeah.
So there's that.
There's that. There's the fact that the whole premise of this movie hinges on Santa needing to find his wife, but like we don't know why. It's never established why that's part of it. Why is heteronormativity?
That's what Jesus said had to happen.
That's what is Jesus. Why don't they ever challenge this institution that is creating all of these clauses?
Yes.
And who is it? Like Mother Earth? Like who's in charge of this? And why can't they defy it?
Well, I would say maybe it is Mother Earth because. There are a few suggestions that she is essentially God, you know, throughout
right.
2 and 3.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
Another thing about this relationship is it's another example of like two people who will end up in a romantic relationship, but they start out hating each other. I don't know why this is such a common premise for a romantic storyline.
Enemies to lovers, baby.
I personally never had that happen to me. I personally never in my life started out hating someone and then ended up like...
marrying them?
Oh, wait. Do you want to like fuck? Like, what's going on?
I feel like we not too long ago quote... Oh, I think it was in the...
It was the You've Got Mail episode.
Yes. There's like a Nora Ephron quote about how nonsensical this setup is, except that she's like, well, but it's a movie, so you have to do it. Where it's like, yeah, I've certainly never absolutely fucking hated someone upon meeting them and then later realized that they were my one true love.
Right.
It's not something that happens. And I would say if it is happening to you, maybe take a look at what's going on. You know, could be maybe a red flag to suddenly be like, actually, I don't fucking hate you. I fucking love you, you know?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then her flipping and deciding that he's not so bad after all. I can't really track that evolution.
The most disturbing part, I think, of that whole arc, more than like her flip and being like wooed or whatever, is in the proposal, Santa essentially says that he groomed her. Like, he's like, it's so weird. He's like,
you've known me all your life.
He's like, I've been with you since you were a kid. I've always been there for you. I've always loved you. Haven't I, Carol?
It's really creepy.
That's so, yeah, that is like perverted to say. And also, it wasn't him. It was one of the old Santas. He's only been Santa for 8 years, which is canon in the movie. Right.
But that makes it feel like Hereditary. It makes it feel like she was bred for this.
Ugh, it's,
you know, like, it makes it feel like she was designed for this.
It's very, very yucky.
And it's weird to have all these elves be like, "Come on, marry him!" Like you can almost see her saying no, and then them grabbing at her and like eating her. You know, like, she's put into
turning
this
on her,
and then she's transformed into something inhuman. Which we see in the credits when she is like turned into this Mrs. Claus, a totally different person than who she was, just dancing around, fattened up, totally different hair. The Santa Claus transformation in the original film, to me, does come off as magical. But the Mrs. Claus transformation comes off as body horror, to me, at least. Like, and that's not me being fat phobic. I'm just saying that, like, this woman was kind of forced into turning into this inhuman, mythological character. That's not her.
Right. And then like the it's supposed to be okay because, well, she can still teach. And so in that way, you know, has she really lost anything? It's like, well, yeah. What about her like family and life and the also a choice in the matter? Yeah, because the elves, I mean, the elves would absolutely eat her if she said no, because their whole fucking ecosystem relies on her saying yes right now. And there, I also thought it was the Abby the elf. There's still, I mean, look, the North Pole is a patriarchy in this movie. There are no girl elves in high up positions. It's Bernard and it's what's his name, little Spencer Breslin, flopping around.
Wait, it's a really high up position to be Santa's waitress.
Like, she's Santa's full-time waitress. And then he's so like emotionally unintelligent that she has to start proposing to Carol for him.
It's so
his little child maid that he flirts with sometimes.
Ooh, I know, it's so creepy. And then part of that proposal is him guilting Carol into marrying him, saying like, "Hey, no pressure, but if I don't get married, you know, Christmas won't happen. The children everywhere will stop believing in Christmas and in Santa. The elves will lose their job." So she like basically has no choice but to be like, "I guess I have to marry you now."
And it's like the stakes being this high is presented as a joke. And then she kind of responds like, "Ha ha ha, well, I guess what else am I supposed to do?" She's like, "Don't come home too late." And then he turns back into Santa before her very eyes. It's very like there's an instant God.
And this also means that Carol now has to sacrifice everything in her life, which does get commented on.
Yeah.
He's like, "I know I'm asking you to leave everything behind, but this place is worth it." But she like has to leave her life, her job, like her family.
She doesn't get to say goodbye. Mm-mm. It doesn't seem like she doesn't get to go back, get her stuff.
And as we've spoken on before in the Santa Claus 3 episode, it does feel like the school she teaches was kind of just created so she had a place to teach.
What exactly
is she teaching? These elves are immortal. Like, how does this work? You know?
And also, it's like she can't teach what they need to know. She's not like,
it's like when a mobster buys a nightclub so that his girlfriend has a place to sing.
This does get suggested at the end of this movie because he's like, "And yes, you can be the principal at the school here that we definitely have at the North Pole for sure. We already have that." Wink, wink.
Yeah, we've been needing one of those.
Yeah, so they're clearly lying about that. But yeah, bottom line, she has to sacrifice everything in her life.
Woohoo!
Before that, I mean, the romance leading up to this very bizarre, scary proposal is, again, him showing up at her house to ask her out
on
a
date. It's one
date. And they go on one date.
It is one date.
And they have the worst kiss in all of movies.
Yeah.
I was worried that he was going to wait a long time, because I didn't remember how this movie pans out exactly. I wasn't sure about the like specific plot points. And I was worried that he was going to wait a long time to tell Carol that he is Santa, because that's the type of thing where in a movie like this, the character, often a man, would keep this secret and like keep lying to his love interest. So I was surprised.
He's upfront about it, though.
He's upfront about it. He tells her very quickly. It's like at the end of their first and only date.
Yeah.
What he should have done is invited her back to the house he was staying at, his ex's house, brought her to the backyard and been like, "Here's a reindeer. Look at him fly." You know? That would have been the same moral thing, like him revealing his secret, but in a way that's like, there you go. You know, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, here's your decision.
I would say, honestly, telling someone you're Santa at the end of a first date, that's too soon. I don't want to know at the end of a first date.
I would want to know. But also,
I would want to know on a second date for some reason.
It's confusing that she doesn't believe him because she's seen what is clearly magic on display that he is doing in front of her very eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then when he like contextualizes it, she's like, no, you're making fun of me because I told you about my Christmas trauma.
Yeah, that's such a leap too. Like, I told you that I had, like, I liked Christmas, but then a kind of bad thing happened that maybe a lot of people would probably not still be caught up on. But, like, and you're making fun of me by, like, imagine being, like, hurt by that, too. Like, even if he was joking, right? Like, being like,
right.
How dare you joke that you're Santa Claus, you know?
She was really put on. I mean, I almost got there with understand because she was, but she's like, what, are you making fun of me because of my Christmas trauma? And now you're telling me you're Santa Claus? I'm like, I don't know that that would be an antagonistic response. It would be a weird one if he were making it up. Mm-hmm. But I don't.
Yeah.
But who cares?
Also, in that scene where they're bond, I guess we're supposed to think that they are bonding over their love of Christmas or her former love of Christmas. I don't know. Whatever they bond over is like definitely not enough to build a marriage on because it's like pizza crust and the model of some random car.
But the clause doesn't require, as Grace pointed out, a happy marriage. It just requires a marriage.
And this is just to go to my point that if this whole movie had just been about that romance, could have been good.
Sure.
Been good.
But
yeah.
They have like, I don't know, 10 pages of the screenplay allocated to developing this romance, so you hardly get any of that, and then the movie just like presents this very weird rushed thing where he's like, by the way, I came here to find a wife, but I didn't expect to fall in love because that's not detailed in the clause. I don't need to do that.
Which is also so bleak.
And then, then she's like, wait a minute, you love me? Oh my gosh, wow, awesome.
Awesome.
But I mean, the way romantic love is depicted in almost every movie is upsetting.
It's not good. Can we talk about Lucy?
Yes.
Which I think, Grace, did you say that sounds like a whole other movie?
Yeah, I mean, like, the first movie was all about Charlie and Santa's relationship.
Mm-hmm.
This movie tries to get that again. So Lucy, I don't know if we've been clear enough, is Neil and
Neil and Laura's kid.
Yeah.
And I like that we see that Lucy has a good relationship with Scott. That's nice.
Yeah, that's cool. That is cool.
Yeah.
Like, and in broad strokes, I guess it's cool. Like, they keep, like, kind of gaslighting her about, like, how Scott isn't Santa. Like, maybe that's too severe of a word, but, like, they keep telling, being like, oh, no, that reindeer and all that, that he's not Santa. But the thing is, they really try to have their cake and eat it, too, in a million ways in this movie, including by trying to have another Charlie Santa story engine, but with Lucy, and Lucy has, like, 12 minutes of screen time. You know, like, it just isn't, yeah. It's just not there.
It's not. And I Lucy, doesn't she come back for three? She's back in three?
She does. She does, yeah. And she doesn't really have much of a character other than she loves Christmas.
Right.
Charlie had more. Charlie had, like, some sass to him, some comedy about him. And
yeah.
Lucy is just, like, when they need a kid to be, like, but on Christmas, you're not supposed to fight, or yada, 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 that sort of thing.
Right.
There she is.
And there she is, baby. I don't, yeah, I wish that there was a little, because that kid is so cute, and I liked the idea of, like, building a relationship with her and Charlie, but the end scene you get with them is so bleak, where Charlie just sort of is just, like, the knowledge that your stepfather is Santa. Don't let it be a burden. Let it be a gift. But if you fucking tell anyone, the whole family is screwed. Like, it's just, oh, there's all of these, like, burdens on this family. Mm-hmm. And then Laura has been, like, incepted by someone. Where'd she go? I wonder what the thinking was behind that, like, totally removed. I'm like, can you not have two adult women with opinions in one movie? Like, do you have to take them and then give them?
In the Santa Claus movies, it seems part of the Christmas magic is an enchantment in the North Pole where if you're a woman who goes there, you are lobotomized forever.
Right.
And now you are just like a servant, docile.
It's not good. It's a very, it's a very sinister vibe when an adult woman is taken to the North Pole. It never ends well for them.
No.
All right. Is there anything else people want to touch on?
Just that. I mean, yeah, I guess we talked a little bit about Abby the elf seeming to be an important elf, but only in the sense that she brings
Cocoa
to Santa, whereas like Curtis and Bernard are the ones making important decisions.
I feel like there's still kind of weird vibes between her and Santa, but at least it's not like in the first movie where they like explicitly flirt with each other.
Yeah, that will never leave me.
That was awful.
Like, so good on you, the Santa Claus 2 writers, for not having that happen.
Right. Also, at the end, she has to be saved by Charlie when the toy soldiers are attacking the elves.
Yes.
And that doesn't make any sense. He just, like, he rappels down.
Right. From where?
He's like, that's my new thing. Yeah. Oh, bad boy Charlie. We love him. Yeah, and then also, I mean, I feel like this is an extension of what happens in the first movie, but because Neil's goofiness is turned up to an 11, like in the first and in all movies of this era, any therapist character is like, what a loser. This person's doing nothing for no one. Therapy is for weak people and we don't believe in it. And like this one, it goes even further.
At one point, Scott is like, have you ever helped a single person?
Yeah.
And Neil says nothing.
Right. Like, yeah, it's like cartoonishly over the top in terms of like that. I don't know. But that was, again, like so many Disney movies of that time. Cause it's, I always think of it, the Jamie Lee Curtis Freaky Friday character too, where like the people who come to her when she's a therapist and that are like so overplayed and so like othered and demonized. And you don't see any of Neil's patients, but you just see him being absolutely like read to shit over and over and over of like, your job isn't real. Mm-hmm. Like, and from Santa Claus. Santa Claus is saying, I don't consider your job legitimate. Like, that's dark. That's fucked up.
Yeah. Mother Earth, played by Aisha Tyler.
Yeah.
The only woman of color with a speaking role in the entire movie. And while she is in a leadership role because she's maybe God.
She's God.
Yeah. She is God. She's playing the role of God and yet has nothing to do.
Nothing to do. The Tooth Fairy has way more narrative significance than she does. Although I think it was an interesting and subversive choice to make the Tooth Fairy a man in this franchise.
And I wanted to just shout out the actor who played the Tooth Fairy died this week.
Rest
the week
peace.
That we record. He died very recently. Art LaFleur.
Rest
so he's been in a million movies.
Truly a great character actor. Really, really a great character actor.
So
if you don't know who he is, like from us saying his name or whatever, if you see his face, you'll have a million memories of him. So rest in peace.
Yes.
I like the Tooth Fairy character. But I wish that they'd use the whole league a little more because they have so many good, like, you know, they have Michael Dorn. I always forget Michael Dorn is Sandman, and Michael Dorn is like, work-life balance is important. And that's sort of his whole role in this movie. I don't know.
And Frank from Everybody Loves Raymond, but his Scott's boss from the first film is
Father Time.
Father Time,
right.
Whoa, I didn't even connect that.
Yeah.
Wild.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Everyone at the North Pole only speaks English and with an American accent, as if
the And Christmas in the first movie, there's British elves. I mean, it's still English, but there are British elves in the first movie.
This time it's just like,
I think it would have been much cooler if they had summoned Mother Earth to help them travel by like cutting off the head of a sheep. And like rubbing
now
the blood on
talking.
A tree or
now
something.
Exactly.
I mean, rise from the dirt and suck them up. And
Grace,
them
save it for your Santa Claus 4 pitch. I don't really have anything else to say about this.
I mean, it doesn't pass the Bechdel test. It like that, and I don't think it's even close.
Well,
okay.
If you consider that
she's building an argument. I can see the wheels turning.
Wait. There is a scene where Lucy goes, "Mom," and Laura goes, "Yes." And Lucy says, "I lost another tooth. Should I put it under my pillow?" And then Scott.
There we go. This movie passes the Santa Claus 2 passes the Bechdel test.
No.
Not meaningfully.
No, but that tooth is important. That is a narratively important tooth. No, yeah. It passes. Oh, my God.
I don't feel great about it either.
I don't feel good about that at all. But
this is perfect. It's perfect that this is how we're ending this. By recognizing that the Santa Claus 2 passes the Bechdel test.
I mean, Caitlin, that meets every criteria. It is like you can't deny that that tooth is important.
Yeah, I know. So,
oh my God.
The verdict is in.
It passes.
Unless there's a secret clause to the Bechdel test that we don't know about and we are just finding out.
Get Spencer in here. Where's Spencer?
Yeah, we need his magnifying glasses. But yes, let's rate the movie on our nipple scale, 0 to 5 nipples, based on an examination of the movie through an intersectional feminist lens. I'm going to give this, I guess, like 1 nipple, a half nipple between the ludicrous romantic storyline that is creepy and based on absolutely nothing aside from Santa needing his wife to continue justifying his existence, Carol being forced and guilted into a marriage after going on one date with the guy, her having to sacrifice everything in her life as a result. I hate it. The movie does introduce several new female characters, but
some are now just a husk of their former selves. But technically, yes, there are many people. There are women in the movie.
Homunculi.
There.
Ho ho ho, homunculi.
But most of the women who are present are not really contributing much to the story, or they don't have any agency, or they get coerced into a marriage with Santa Claus at the last minute. So I don't like it. I'm going to go down to a half nipple. I'll give my half nipple to Comet the Reindeer.
Oh my gosh, no. Wait. I can't tell you what to do. I forgot to say Comet was a, I've talked about this on the show many times, but this specific era of like combining animatronics with CGI used to scare the living shit out of me. And yeah. Comet is a formative example of like, I can't look at this or it's gonna haunt me, like really haunt me. Comet is a scary looking, the way the eyes, it's not mm-hmm. good. I feel absolutely fucking defeated by the fact that this movie passes the Bechdel test. It kind of blows my mind. And it really is like giving me a headache to think about. And you know, like when you're at a point where you're like, you can feel in your sign, you're like, I could get a nosebleed at any second. So I'm going to give it 5 nipples because this has been a 3-year journey we've been on.
Wow.
With the Santa Claus movies. We went 1, 3, 2 because we're not like other girls. We're not going to do it in order. I'm going to give it 5 nipples because I think that this is the first one that passed the Bechdel test. And is it my least favorite of the 3 by a long shot? Absolutely. I don't like this one. I don't enjoy watching it. I won't be returning to it. Unlike the Santa Claus 1 and 3, which I will be coming back to for years to come.
Sure.
I can't believe I lost a tooth. Should I put underneath my pillow? Yes, you should. And then, so I have to give it 5 nipples. I have to give it 5 nipples, and I'm giving them all to Bernard again.
Oh, very good.
Grace?
I also have to give it 5 nipples.
No. Oh my God.
Sorry, Caitlin.
Because
it's now in the top 5% of movies we've ever covered.
How could I give any less than a 100% score? How could I give any less mm-hmm. than 5 nipples to the very air that I breathe? The Santa Claus films are inside of me and outside of me, and they're like,
wow.
The Santa Claus films are what my pastor told me Jesus was. Like, always with me, always there for me. And how am I supposed to give a negative review of a building block of life itself.
Mm.
I just don't think that I can do that.
Caitlin should have really thought of that before she came here.
I just don't think that I can do that. I'm going to give my five nipples, I'm going to give each one of them to a different one of my close friends.
Ooh.
And have them take care of them as if they are each a key that when combined...
What?
...is able to unlock something in me that is like a pure joy that might need to be unlocked in the future in a dark time. So I'm going to disperse these nipples amongst my friends that will be keepers of the Santa Claus 2 nipples. And they'll be able to use them in a time of great need in the future. Mm. And if I pass away before that time comes, I hope they use the nipples to unlock a great Christmas joy in somebody else. Like, say, a fascist dictator. You know, like, if Trump gets reelected, use those nipples to teach him the true meaning of Christmas.
That is so beautiful, and I'm crying. That's really, really beautiful.
She really is, listeners. She really is.
Jamie.
I can't. Look.
There's a waterfall going on across Jamie's face right now.
I can't stop fucking crying, and this is really hard for me.
Jamie, I'm sorry you're crying.
Thank you.
Grace, thank you for coming back. And
thank God.
Completing the trifecta of the Santa Claus trilogy and making this the best holiday tradition I've ever participated in.
Yeah, maybe the only holiday tradition I've ever participated in, really. I love Christmas, but I've had a hard childhood.
Oh, we've got 5 hours of audio on that, I actually think.
Where can people follow you online and check out your stuff?
Well, two things. One, I never mentioned that I rewatched it with motion smoothing on because I'm watching it on my in-laws' television and I couldn't figure out how to turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it even more surreal and weird and like stomach wrenching. And I suggest everyone should do that. To really be able to, like, look at the world and what it is in a new way. where can you follow me? I'm at Grace G. Freud on Twitter. I have a newsletter, too, that's, like, tinyletter.com/Grace Freud. I'm part of a comedy duo called Girl God, and we are doing a never-ending tour. We're in Chicago in December, Los Angeles in January. We're back in New York in February. We've got more shows to announce soon. Also, watch Rick and Morty in 2 years when my episode comes out.
2023, there's some fucking bangers.
Thank you guys for having me. I've really loved this so much. And I'm glad that this is the only thing I've ever completed in my life. So I'm glad that we finished out the trilogy.
Wow.
Oh, thank you, Grace. We love you.
That's beautiful. It's a Christmas miracle.
Speaking of shows, we're going to be at San Francisco Sketch Fest. We keep forgetting to promote this show that is actually quite soon.
Whoa. Yes.
We're going to be back. It's on January 19th. And you can come if you're in San Francisco. We're going to be releasing additional tour dates soon. So you can just imagine what's around San Francisco, what's directly, you know, above San Francisco. And also, Caitlin and I want to go to Vegas.
We might go to Vegas.
The North Pole is directly above San Francisco.
We're going to the North Pole.
Yeah.
You know, I know that we've said adult women shouldn't go to the North Pole, but we're just going to see what happens.
Well, Jamie, I've been proposed to by Santa, and I have to say yes, so we're going to the North Pole.
Wow, I'm gonna try my luck with Bernard, see if he'll have me.
Best of luck.
And truly. I am gonna fuck a reindeer. Peace out, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie.
Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
Well, how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.